ॐ स्थापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणे अवतारवरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णाय ते नमः श्रुतिस्मृतिपुराणानाम् आलयं करुणालयं नमामि भगवत्पादं शङ्करं लोकशङ्करम् So, this morning I was trying to focus on this central teaching of Vedanta as explained in this text. That is, in everything in this creation, there are two fundamental categories. One, the eternal, the unchanging, the permanent, and the non-eternal, the transitory, the momentary. The eternal is Asti, Bhadi, and Priyam, Satchidananda, the existence, knowledge, and bliss, absolute. Now, we must remember that Vedanta emphasizes again and again the fact that the absolute reality is beyond explanation. It can only be explained. So even the highest philosophy, even all the Upanishads, Vedanta scriptures, are only trying to explain what is beyond explanation. Then why do we take all the trouble to study the books? That's because we have so many other ideas in mind, which are not helpful for understanding the highest truth. So we must push out, remove all the wrong ideas in our mind, all the ideas which take us away from Vedanta, and we must focus on one idea which will take us closer to Vedanta, the highest spiritual experience. Because when we interpret ourselves as drishyam, the seeing, the perceived objects, then we are actually moving away from truth. So all scriptures are only attempts to remove all the wrong notions. And when you remove all wrong notions, what is left is the right knowledge. So you'll be surprised. Advaita non-dualistic philosophy tells you that scriptures cannot reveal the truth. I shall explain. In Shankaracharya's Bhashya, in the Mandukya Upanishad Bhashya, there is a statement. Shastram tu ajnana nivartakam na jnana pravartakam. What it means is, all scriptures remove darkness. And when all darkness is removed, what is left is light. So you can imagine, for example, when you could not recognize the rope for a rope, when you mistook it for a snake, and then when you bring light, what happens? The darkness is removed. And the fact that it is a piece of rope is not revealed by light. It reveals itself. So in Vedanta, when you realize the truth, you are not getting any new knowledge. You are discovering your true nature. You are coming back to your home. You are self-discovering. All the wrong notions are removed. And when all wrong notions are removed, when all darkness is gone, what is left out is light. And in that light, the truth is naturally removed. Because the really speaking, darkness cannot have any impact on the rope. The darkness can only obstruct your understanding for some time. So that's why Vedanta is a very interesting, that's one of the unique aspects of Vedanta. In fact, that's why Vivekananda had so much of impact when he came to this country. You can give the background, historical background, the historical philosophical landscape of this country when Vivekananda appeared in 1893. See, the East Coast especially was still very Eurocentric. So Darwin's teachings, you know, evolutionism, the origin of species, then Marxian ideology, you know, radical humanism, socialist humanism, and then explosive developments in science and technology, all these have shaken the foundations of any kind of religious faith, which tells you, don't ask questions, you just listen to me and follow me. So America's intellectual landscape was not willing to accept a kind of theological dogmatism. We did not allow you to ask any question. So when Vivekananda came to this country, what he told, in fact, the whole essence of Chicago lectures and all the lectures that he did in this country for 4 years is this. You realize the truth within you. Truth is not produced by anybody. You just turn your attention to yourself. You find a God whom you are seeking in temples and churches. You find that God sitting within your own heart, and that God is not different from you. This is the essence of all that he taught. So, and one aspect that he emphasized again and again was, there are four stages in the evolution of our concept of God and also our own evolution. Rituals, mythology, philosophy, and experience. Rituals are different in each tradition. Mythology also may be different. Philosophy, maybe at the level of philosophy, there may be many common factors, but experience is the only ultimate criterion for spirituality. Just like, and when you reach that experience, you're like reaching the top of the hill. When you down, you find all the religious traditions are equally varied parts leading you to the highest destination. So when you reach the experience, that is experience, mind you, not at the philosophical level, not theological level, not mythological level, not at the level of rituals, you don't find anything common in religious traditions. There are socio-anthropological factors which divide religion from religion. But when you reach the experience level, it's just like reaching the top of the hill. And when you look down from the top of the hill, then you find so many people are taking so many roads, so many tracks and trails, trying to reach the same summit of the mountain. But you don't realize this unless you reach the top of the hill. When you follow your own track, when we follow our own trail, we think we are the only traveler, no one else. And ours is the only road that will take you to the top of the hill. But when you reach the top of the hill, look down, you find all these roads and trails are so many paths leading a sincere seeker to the same goal. That's why when you reach this level, you don't call it Asti Bhadi Priyam or Sachidananda. It cannot be called anything. So every scripture, every statement is only an approximation of the absolute reality. It is not a definition. So Vedanta tells you sarva pramana avati is the word. You know what it means? It means the highest truth is beyond all tools of epistemology. So that I don't have time to go through this, but in brief, in one, two sentences, I will tell you, Vedanta believes in a very elaborate epistemological tradition, which means direct perception, inference, analogy or comparison, then verbal testimony, presumption, and non-existence, anubilabdhi. That means pratyaksha, pramana, vamana, sabda, arthabhati, anubilabdhi. I'm not going to those details. What it means to say, truth, the absolute truth, can only be experienced, can never be explained. So that is an important point to remember when you step into any book on non-dualistic philosophy. So when you reach the experience level, then you find it is beyond all books, all ideas, all philosophical concepts. It is called anubhavaika vedyam in Sanskrit, means something that can only be experienced, can never be explained. That's why this experience cannot be explained in any way. So Vedanta tells you why this cannot be explained. Well, it is called yes sakshat aparokshat brahma. You know, the meaning is pratyaksha, direct perception means something that you can see and understand with your eyes, any senses of perception and mind. It cannot be Vedanta, the highest Brahman, Atman cannot be seen like that. But it is not remote. It is not direct. It is not remote because your true nature is Atman. So it is called non-indirect. Aparoksha it is called. Why? Because it's our true nature. And this truth is the unchanging reality. So in Vedanta, it is called Sakshi, as I mentioned in the beginning, witness. What is Sakshi? Sakshi is, the literal meaning may be witness. We do all our actions using our senses of perception and senses of action, and even while doing all these actions are possible by the presence of Atman, but Atman is not involved in any action. But Atman's presence, Atman's as Sakshi in his proximity, we are able to see with our eyes, we are able to hear with our ears, we are able to taste with our tongue, and so on. So, it is Sakshi. The word Sakshi, that should be understood. That is, in the Sanskrit tradition, and this very profound definition is the Audasinitva Bhodrutva Sakshitva, means this Atman is a non-participating witness. At the same time, it is of the nature of awareness. Now, you know, you don't call a person a witness. God won't recognize you as a witness if you have participated in an action. You should have witnessed it, but you should be a non-participant in it. So, you are aware of it, but you are not participating in it. Like that, our true nature is not something that is involved in action, but that's something that witnesses action. Actually, if we can, at least at the intellectual level, if we can look upon ourselves as a witness, we'll be able to remove many of the problems. I can give an example. When you meditate, for example, when you meditate, you find, actually you are trying to transcend the level of your mind and body. You're trying to connect yourself with something that goes to the body-mind complex. But that creates conflicts. Why it creates conflicts? That means there is a conflict between what you consider yourself to be now and what you are trying to be. So when we try to meditate, when we pray, you find a secondary personality is emerging in our system. So when you, if this, not necessarily in meditation, if you go to university, read a wonderful book on mysticism, and you are impressed by that book, and then if you are a spiritual seeker, and suddenly you are struck, there is another aspect to life. There you find another possibility in our own life, another possibility for our own personality, which you want to be. You come back from the library or the temple or a church after reading or prayer or meditation, again you are back to what you are. But next day again you try to connect with the secondary personality. Now, Jung, in fact, was one of the one of the first modern psychologists who used the word secondary personality in his own book. But not in this sense. He said, when psychological analysis, there is a secondary personality emerging. But actually, the credit for this concept goes to Vedantic literature. So Vedanta tells you, when you go to a church or a temple or a lonely place, sit for some time and try to think of a higher spiritual idea. And if you are a true, sincere seeker, suddenly you feel, well, this is something which I want to be. you find another possibility for our own life. At that time, the secondary personality that is emerging is somewhat weak. That's why when we come out of the temple or church, we forget it. But next day, again when we go, again we are reminded of this. Yoga psychology calls you vikshiptam manaha. Vikshiptam manaha means mind that moves like a pendulum of a clock, one end, and then it doesn't stop at the middle, it goes to the other end. Now, when we continue the spiritual practices, then the secondary personality becomes stronger and stronger. Its voice is heard more audibly, becomes louder, if we sincerely practice meditation and all that. That means what we want to be becomes stronger and stronger, and what we are right now fades into the background. What does it mean? There is another possibility in our system. And that possibility is Sakshi. And the more we associate, the more we connect ourselves with the Sakshi dimension of our own personality, the more peace and happiness you feel within. Because why? Because suddenly we are connecting with one higher dimension of our personality. We doesn't feel any kind of fatigue, anxiety, depression, or anything. It is something higher. And as we practice meditation, prayer, or even by any kind of practice that feeds our mind with spiritual ideas. It could be reading wonderful books. It may be association of people whose association will remind you of your higher dimension. There are many people whose association may pour cold water on your head. Okay, and that's why in the Vedanta tells you, you have to keep a long distance from them. So, Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Ubeksha. In yoga psychology and also in the Bhagavata Purana, there is an interesting description. One philosopher king called Nimi puts one question to a saint, Antariksha. There are 9 stages. Nimi Navayogi Samvada. It means a dialogue between 9 philosopher saints and a philosopher king. A dialogue. So the king asked 9 questions. One question to each of the saints. The first question is about how to go beyond Maya, etc. The second question is very interesting. That is, who is an ideal seeker? The third question is, who is a true devotee? So the saint tells the king that a true devotee of God is one who feels the presence of God in everything and in everyone, and the presence of everything in God. So sarva bhudeshuya pasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavadottamaha. Those who are interested, you can read the 11th Skandha book of Bhagavata Purana, Nimi Navayogi Samvada, the 2nd chapter, in which the sage Antariksha explains the highest devotee is one who feels the presence of God in everything and the presence of everyone in God. Then the king, the sage anticipates another question for the king. What about those who are not the highest state? See, most of us, for example, we go to temples, we go to churches, we go to places of worship, we read scriptures, and we feel very happy. After some time, again, we are back to square one. Again, next day when we go to a place of worship, again we feel wonderful. So, mind remains somewhat unsteady. You are struggling to strengthen the secondary personality. But frequently, there is a deviation, we forget it. So, how to avoid this problem? What the sage tells the king? He says, Ishware tadadhineshu barisheshu dithasya prema maitri kriba ubeksha yakkarodi sa madhyamaha. Let me explain. You know, without the Sanskrit statements, the ideas will not come to my mind. They come together, so I can't help it. So, that's why if I forget the Sanskrit statement, I forget everything. So, what it means is this. the king tells about those who are still seekers, trying to build up the spiritual life, trying to listen to the secondary personality, whom you listen to when you try to meditate. He says, you should have devotion to God, and you should have compassion to other spiritual seekers, should not look down upon others, and you should be able to admire when you find somebody who is higher than you, more advanced than you in spiritual life. But then you should keep a long distance from those whose association will kill your own faith and will shake your own conviction, will turn you to skeptic. So cynicism, skepticism, doubt, kind of negative attitude, all these are poisons for spiritual life. That's why the first important qualification and characteristic of a true spiritual seeker, you know what Lord Krishna says in the Gita, Santushta Satadam Yogi Yadatma Dhrinischeha, he gives a list of all the fundamental characteristics of a devotee, of a spiritual seeker, a good person, to be very frank. It is, he will be santushta, he will be contented. And if anybody shakes your contentment, if anybody shakes your faith and turns you into spiritual bankrupt, creates a spiritual bankruptcy within, keep a long distance. That is, upeksha is the word used in Bhagavata Purana. It comes in the Yoga Sutra literature also, while dealing with obstacles in meditative life. One important medicine prescribed by Patanjali is keep a long distance from those who will shake your conviction, who will create doubtfulness, skepticism in your mind. Keep a long distance. So one important way of testing a person is association. Is he making me spiritually better or creating a big vacuum, a darkness in my mind? That person should be avoided like poison. Okay, so here the point is this, how to strengthen the secondary personality, the sakshi dimension of our personality. One is feeding our mind with spiritual food and avoiding poison. What is poison for spiritual life? And the most dangerous thing is skepticism and wrong association. The reason is, it is not about believing in somebody whom you don't see. It is in discovering the truth that is already within you. So for that, for example, Vedanta tells you, Brahman or Atman cannot be explained. It is Trigala Atida, Sarvigara Atida, Avasthatraya Abadida, and so on. It is beyond six changes. It is birthless and deathless. It is beyond explanation. And it is beyond time, space, causation. It is beyond past, present, and future. So what is the use of that, going after this kind of thing? One may ask the question. He cannot understand this. And you cannot see Brahman, and you cannot read about Brahman. No book can explain that. And not only that, it is also stated you can know it only through experience. So we are actually removing all the dirt and filth from our own mind and trying to discover the truth that is already within us. And that truth can be experienced as one ultimate witness present in all the three states of human consciousness: waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. That is another important subject discussed in this book. That is, this absolute reality, you can feel its presence within yourself if you observe your own states of consciousness in our everyday life. So Vedanta calls that sakshi as turiya, as the non-participating witness, is the drashta, the seer, perceiver, present in the waking state, present in the dream state, still present in deep sleep state, and transcending all the three. So that is one important teachings of Vedanta. Somebody was asking the question in the morning, what is that absolute reality? So I shall explain that. It's a bit metaphysical. I've already mentioned earlier, but I shall try to explain this. Philosophically, it's very important. This absolute reality is considered to be beyond the triple time dimensions. It is beyond past, present, and future. So it is beyond all changes. It never is never born because it is never absent. It's always present. It never dies. It never undergoes the process of existence, because existence in the Vedantic terminology at the empirical level means something that comes into existence and for that reason ceases to exist sometime in future. This Atman is not like that. It never grows, it never evolves, and it never decays, it never dies. It's called Trikala, Abadhida, and Shadvikara, Atida, and it remains the same in the past, present, and future, and in the states of waking, dream, and deep sleep state. Now, again, as I mentioned this morning, this may appear to be something very abstract, far above the clouds hanging that we cannot reach. Shankaracharya says it is not far away. It may appear to be far away when you say it cannot be explained. It is called Pancha Shabda Pravruti Nishedha. What it means, it cannot be explained, cannot be verbalized. So when you want to explain something at empirical level, you need some associations. See, you may tell a person, well, he is a musician. So by indicating his work, you call him a musician. A flower, you may call it a red flower by indicating its color. Or you may, he is my uncle or brother, indicating a relationship. Or is this like sun, which is known to everyone. Or you may say it's an animal or an insect, you may use like that. It's called jadi, drivya, guna, sambandha, and kriya. These are the five conditions of verbalization. Atman cannot be explained like this. So naturally, you may think, better don't go forward, don't worry about it. It's a big headache. But Shankaracharya tells you, if we want to live a happy and intelligent life in this world, then you should at least intellectually try to understand your transcendental dimension. It is necessary even for mental health. Because, as I mentioned, if you want mental health, you should link your mind to something beyond mind. If you want physical health, you should link your body to intellect. If a person thinks a slight scratch on the body and if he becomes terribly upset, you should ask him to read history or philosophy or mysticism. Then, even if he's physically sick, you find many people, you know, they read all the short stories, thrillers they read. At least in thrillers, or movies they read. Why? They want to run away from their body. So, you run towards mind to run away from the body. The mind is also not an ultimate source of health. Mind also becomes unhappy and sick. So, you have to run away from mind. And link your mind to something that is beyond mind, Atman. So that's what Shankaracharya says. So he says, we all are engaged in some kind of activities. Physical, mental, intellectual activities. Mind, body, intellect, or nervous system. So this is inescapable, unavoidable. It is totally inescapable. So Shankaracharya makes a statement in the Gita Bhashya, he says, Karmanishthayaha Chitta Suddhidvarena Purushartha Hedutvam Na Swadandrena Jnana Nishthadu Swadandrena Purushartha Hedhu Anyan Apeksha. It may look a bit abstract, very simple. What he says is, whatever you are doing, factory, university, office, hospital, whatever work, wherever we are working, all that work which we normally do, which we cannot run away from, which we cannot escape from, can become a tool for reaching this highest spiritual goal. That is the great kind of spiritual humanism and the kind of spiritual pragmatism you find in Advaita Vedanta. No other system of philosophy tells you. Ramanuja, Madhva Ramanuja says, you know, you pray to God, but so what about people who don't believe in God? There are many wonderful people. Buddha, for example, he did not believe in God. He never went to a temple and prayed. One of the greatest spiritual personalities the world has seen. How can you say Buddha was not spiritual? Confucius, Lao Tzu, many. Many people, wonderful people in the world who did not believe in a creator God. They were nearer to God in reality than many so-called conventional believers. So how do you explain this? Shankaracharya says, it's a very classic interpretation of spiritual humanism and spiritual pragmatism, rather Advaitic pragmatism. What he says is, whatever we do, any kind of action, action doesn't mean physical action. A thought is an action, the mental level. An idea coming, flashing in the mind is also an action. Any all these actions can be given a spiritual orientation, a spiritual turn. Normally, whatever we do, you know, with great anxiety, with great obsession, professional efficiency, enthusiasm, all such actions bind us to something, mentally and spiritually enslave us. You may do something and may be worried about its result. So action is not so very not a very desirable thing. Every action is inherently faulty, according to Vedanta, unless it is done as karma yoga. Because I can give an explanation to drive home the spiritual humanism of Vedanta. See, normally we interpret the effectiveness or success of an action only on the basis of its immediate tangible result. Well, suppose a person works hard and makes a lot of money, and that money makes him more greedy, and he has to take pills for getting 2 hours sleep every day, and he's depressed, and he's always in competition. Now, do you think all his actions from a very empirical, superficial point of view were efficient because he could pile up dollars? Rupees, nothing, you know, dollars, let's say. But then the fellow cannot sleep for 2 hours without taking pills. So do you think his action is really success? So success, to be success, should enable you to enjoy your success. So a person who piles up billions of dollars cannot enjoy the results of his own success, his own work, success of his own activities. So his action is not a success. It becomes a success only if he remains healthy enough to enjoy the fruits of the results of his own actions. Then only he is successful. But Vedanta tells you, you can actually, on the one hand, you can succeed in material life and you need not be enslaved by your own success. Success can be a serious problem if the success turns a person a physical and mental wreck. So Shankaracharya tells you, all these activities can be linked to a spiritual ideal. And in a general sense, the word is used yoga. Yoga doesn't mean standing on your head. The Vedanta helps you to stand on your feet rather. So, spiritually, mentally sick. So what it says is something very interesting. Every action, every thought, every word can be given a spiritual dimension. Then becomes karma yoga. And the karma yoga eventually refines and purifies and spiritualizes our life and mind. And it, on the one hand, helps us to succeed in life. On the other hand, it helps us to enjoy the fruits of success because we are no more slave of our success. There is something beyond success in material life. When we link ourselves to that higher ideal, then spiritual life becomes complete. So that's a unique Vedanta humanism, that's Advaita tells you. So Asti Bhadi Priyam is our spiritual dimension. Nama Rupa constitute Jagat and Jiva, all these things. Nama Rupa, actually they constitute the relative, the Mithya, the Vyavahariga, the relative entity. But even that can be turned into a tool for achieving spiritual success and material success. That Vivekananda uses in a very simple language, the world is a gymnasium for us to work out our karmas. You don't go to gymnasium to live there. Gymnasium is a tool for you to be able to live in this world. So nama, rupa, they constitute the changing, the transitory, momentary things, they can be turned into a useful tool for higher life. That's an idea that you find in here. Now, another very interesting subject discussed in this book is creation itself. So creation, in Vedanta, it is called Srishti. So we should remember, if you read Vedanta metaphysics, you find Vedanta metaphysics turns more towards evolutionism rather than creationism. From a logical point of view, from an epistemological point of view, even from an ontological point of view, Vedanta leans more towards the evolutionistic view rather than the creationistic view. And that's a very interesting thing. So I shall explain this. The verse in the Dridrishya Viveka about creation is Srishti Nama Brahma Rubi Satchidananda Vastuni Abdhau Fena Divat Sarva Nama Rupa Prasarana. Those who are interested, you can look at the 14th verse, or you may remember when you listen to the video again. Srishti Nama Brahma Rubi Satchidananda Vastuni. What is Srishti? Srishti in Vedanta is not creation, really speaking. In Vedanta, Srishti is a projection. So the absolute seen or wrongly interpreted as the non-absolute is Srishti. So suppose you wrongly tell me the waves are different from the ocean, or the waves are different from the water in an ocean, it is totally absurd, ridiculous. So Vedanta tells you this world as name and form is unreal, but this world as Brahman behind is real. This I shall try to make clear in the light of the analogy we already discussed in detail in the morning. You know very well, you know, frequently Vedantin scholars who tell you the old rope never breaks and old snake never dies. So it is called Raju Sarpa Bhrandi. It is there in our Indian philosophical tradition right from 2nd century BC onwards. In fact, the early writings of Lankavatara Sutra of the Buddhist Vijnanavada, I call Yogacara school, deals with this, in fact. Anyway, coming to the subject, you already know the analogy. Well, when you bring light and when you see that it is not a snake but a rope, what is happening is what you previously mistook to be the snake is now seen correctly as the rope. There are not two entities, only one entity. We wrongly mistook the rope for the snake. So now the snake, what we call sarpatvam or the snake idea, is negated, and in its place, the correct understanding that this piece of rope is revealed. So there are no two entities, only one entity. Similarly, so long as we believe this world is real, so long as we believe we are the psychophysical mechanism, this world is real and the only reality for us. And when we reach the highest spiritual experience in Advaita, what happens is you don't run away from the world. The world in which you live is seen differently. I mean, your sense of priority changes. The same world continues to exist, but you know this world as name and form, they are only relative. This world as Brahman is the reality. To give an example, as you gave the example this morning, if you take a number of jewelry to a goldsmith, who you are maybe selling it. The goldsmith cannot sell your ornaments. So he may be planning to melt them and turn them into gold. He doesn't see the ornaments. He sees only gold. Because he has to judge your ornaments on the basis of the gold value. He's not wear them. He's not going to sell them. He doesn't see or judge or interpret your thing, your ornaments as ornaments. For him, only gold exists. Similarly, those who have reached the highest spiritual experience, they live in this world, but they do not look upon this Nama Rupa Prapancha, this world of names and forms, as something real in itself. It is relative. So, frequently, Dekhabhimane Galide Vignade Paramatmani Yatra Yatra Manavyadi Tatra Tatra Samatheka. This is a statement in this book. It says, Dekhabhimane Galide Vignade Paramatmani. When you transcend your body consciousness, when you go beyond your wrong notion that you are this body, and when you realize you are the Atman, then wherever you see only Atman. Whatever you see in this world reminds you of the transcendental dimension. So a spiritually enlightened person, if he sees oceans and mountains and valleys, they remind you not as places to go for picnic once a week or once a year, but rather as the manifestations, the glory of the infinite reality. A little bit of this you find in Emerson's pantheistic ideas. You find pantheism is a primary stage of where you equate the created phenomenal world to God. It is the early stage of this experience. This is not certainly not ultimate, but early stage where you see beauty, a transcendental beauty in creation itself. And the highest level, you go beyond the beauty dimension, that the world itself reminds you of transcendental existence, not beauty. That's how it goes. Well, before going further, I can give one example. And that if you, those of you who have read the Sri Ramakrishna's Gospel, you find a number of wonderful spiritual teachers came to the temple where Sri Ramakrishna was living. Some of them were Paramahamsa, some of them have reached this stage. On one occasion, one wanderer came. He looked very odd. And he was, in a way, he looked very odd and very strange. He was looking at the Ganga, the world, skies and mountains, and he was very happy, he was jubilant, he was dancing with joy. He plunged to the Ganga and didn't remove his water, went to the place where he shared food with cats and dogs, could you imagine? But they didn't mind. He looked so strange. You may call such a person insane, but there is one difference. Such people will have a special effulgence on their face. If a person is suffering from psychiatric problems, there will be a dark shadow. So, Sri Ramakrishna immediately understood. This man, he has reached a state of Advaitic experience, where he could see everything as a manifestation of the transcendental reality. So he asked his own nephew, Urdaya, to go after him. So this wanderer, the Paramahamsa, Avadhuta, didn't like it. He tried to dissuade Urdaya, but Sri Ramakrishna, but he persisted, and after some time, this great man turned back, and he just said one word. He understood Hriday is going after him for some advice. when you stop seeing any distinction and difference between the ditch water and the pure Ganga, then only you have reached the highest experience. That's the expression you find in there. Now, I'm just giving an interpretation of, a classic example of this. This is not something that you assume. You know, you cannot start doing that sort of thing for effect. You can't do that. It is a state, it is a natural state of spiritual evolution. At one stage, you stop seeing any distinction. Many great spiritual seekers, most of them do not remain at that state. They may experience the unity and oneness and divinity of the whole creation and existence, but they do not necessarily become like this. But I'm just giving one example. Now, coming to the subject, Srishti Nama Brahma Rube Satchidananda Vastuni Abdho Fena Adivat Sarva Nama Rupa Prasarana. This is the verse. What it says is, in the ocean, there are names and forms, bubbles like waves, high waves. Some water sometimes takes the form of a huge tsunami or wave, sometimes low high tide and low tide. Like that, in this Brahman, the same Brahman itself is seen to be independent entities, like waves wrongly interpreted as different from the ocean, or the bubbles in an ocean wrongly interpreted as different from the water of which it is made. This is the essence of this verse. Now, coming to another very interesting subject, Vedanta tells you that there is a reason why we frequently forget this. So, I already mentioned this morning, our true nature is that we are this Atman. But every day, every moment, this world tells us the opposite of this. The world tells us that world is real and everything else is unreal. The world, you open the eyes, open your eyes, and everyday experience normally, apparently, so long as we have not reached the highest spiritual realization, the world appears to tell us, Jagat Satyam Brahma Mithya. This is the word world appears to tell us. The truth is, philosophically, Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. The world that's around us is relative only, not absolutely real. Brahman is the only absolute reality. This is the truth. But every day, every moment, when we get obsessed with small things, when the smallest problem creates anxiety and sorrow and sadness, we are actually, the truth is actually hidden from us. We are actually interpreting the unreal for the real because we don't see real for the real. So, according to Vedanta, this is due to two apparent characteristics of Maya. I shall try to explain this. It requires some interpretation. Saktidvayam hi mayayaha vikshepa avruti rupakam vikshepa shakti lingadi brahmandantam jagat srijet. So, those who are interested can see the 13th verse. Two powers, two shaktidvayam means two powers. They are avarana and vikshepa. So, most of you may have heard of this Maya we discussed this morning. Maya is something that appears to be real so far as we are within it, but recognized to be unreal when we are out of it. That is Maya. Navidyade avidya, that is one interpretation of Maya. Sanna pyasanna pibhyat migano, bhinna pyabhinna pibhyat migano, sangha pyasangha pibhyat migano, mahat bhuda anivachani ruva. Shankaracharya defines Maya in Veka Chudamani. It is neither existence nor non-existence, neither full nor with parts. In fact, Vivekananda, while explaining Maya, gives almost a verbatim translation of this verse from Viveka Chudamani in his lectures when Swamiji explains Maya. So Swamiji calls it Maya, is a statement of fact. So now, how does Maya operate in this world, in our life? So Vedanta tells you it has two dimensions, Shakti Dvayam, means one is Avarana Shakti, one is Vikshepa Shakti. Avarana Shakti means conceals the truth and projects the false. So when something is hidden from you, something else is projected. How does this happen? Well, first of all, it has no ontological reality. It's something like, when did the snake enter the room? You don't ask this question. You may ask this question till you bring light into the room. After recognizing it is a piece of rope, nobody will ask the question because he knows there was no snake at all. So when you realize the supreme truth, then you never ask a question about Maya from the highest philosophical point of view. Before that, we go after this. And then, so long as we try to understand Maya, before getting out of it, it is Mahadbhuta Anirvachaniya Rupa. It is beyond explanation, beyond description. It's like, suppose somebody mistakes a high wave or tides in an ocean as different from the ocean itself. Why? Because he doesn't know. He has not seen calm ocean. He has not seen an ocean which is calm and serene and tranquil. He has seen only an ocean which is always on waves. Those who have seen an ocean in its tranquil, peaceful state will understand that waves are not an inherent part of the ocean phenomenon. It is only an appearance. Water appears to have become a big mountain, you call it a high wave. Water appears to become bubbles, but same water is constitute the ocean. So that is the essence of this mantra. Abdo Fena Divat. That means this manifesting, this world of names and forms in Brahman, which is existence, knowledge and bliss, it's just like form, etc. It is known as creation. Creation is nothing but this. Again, we must remember, Vedanta doesn't accept the idea of a creation as something different from creator. Just as waves are not different from the ocean, so also creation is not a separate entity, separate from creator. This is an important point, remember. So long as we are within this jurisdiction, the realm of Maya, Maya appears to conceal the reality, the truth, and so long as the truth is concealed from us, we mistake the real for the unreal and unreal for the real. It is called Vikshepa, means false projection. This is how it is explained in this book. Now, a few more explanation. This is from a dialectical point of view. The 35th verse, those of you are interested can remember. Brahmanya vasthida maya vikshep avrutha rupini avrutyakhandadam tasmin jagat jivo pragalpayet. Another verse, the same text dealing with the same subject tells you, this Maya, which operates as concealment and projection, it is in Brahman. And it is the indivisible nature of Brahman and makes it appear as the world and embodied beings. So long as we are within it, we mistake the real for the unreal and unreal for the real. Now one important subject comes. How do we get out of this? I already indicated earlier that Shankaracharya says we can always get out of this by giving a new turn to our everyday life and activities. What happens is, whatever we do normally with consciousness, with awareness, becomes a bondage. When we do it with a sense of I have a desire, I'm doing it for a different purpose. The same action, if we do without a selfish motive, becomes a tool that saves you, that breaks the binding chains. That is the unique idea of Shankaracharya. So whatever we can do, in everyday life, we can do that not as karma, but as karma yoga. When this happens, our mind will be emptied of all wrong associations, wrong samskaras, wrong vrittis. When mind gets pure, then we'll be able to understand that this concealed reality is our true nature. When we understand that, then projection stops, false projection also disappears. When that happens, we may ask the question, what's the practical use of that in this life? Well, even intellectually, even at the very intellectual level, if you can always remember, well, all these things are there, but they change. There is something beyond all this which never changes. That's what really matters. When we get this idea, our prioritization changes, our priorities will change. We may live in this world, but whatever we do doesn't necessarily upset us. That's one practical use of this understanding, from a purely intellectual point of view. By reading, by reminding ourselves, this works. And at the spiritual level, there is a transition, a journey from idea to experience, from doctrine to reality. One may read in books. Those who are sincere seekers, very earnest seekers, can start practicing karma yoga. Practicing karma yoga doesn't require you have to learn something new, you have to start something new. Only we have to change the perspective, our mind, attitude behind our actions. It doesn't require any special effort. Remember, Shankaracharya's greatness is he accommodates even people who do not believe in a creator God. He accommodates them into spiritual kingdom. He says, even those who do not believe in God can practice his karma yoga. And Vivekananda, for focusing on this aspect of Advaita, tells you, that's very interesting, you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you do not accept him. Now, this unique teaching can come only from Vedanta. Vedanta doesn't reject anything, but it goes beyond all conventional understanding definitions of religion as a whole. So once we understand, well, beyond all this which make me sad or unhappy, there is something that really matters. And that's what really counts in life. This intellectual understanding itself becomes a great help in spiritual life. If you read the lives of some modern thinkers, well, I can give Western Indologists, you can give the example, those who studied Vedanta, I'm talking about conventionally, Paul Dewson, Max Muller, some of them are examples. You find, we cannot say that they have reached the samadhi or anything. But you find, if you read their life, they were devoting the whole lifetime to study, interpret, and think of these ideas. And they thought they were doing a great thing. And men like Max Muller, for example, who accidentally happened to read Vedanta, you know, he was commissioned by the Anglican Church of England to translate Vedas into English so that that would help him to convert Hindus into Christianity. The letter is still in existence. The letter commissioning Max Muller to do this. When Max Muller started reading these ideas, he gave up everything else. He and his wife spent their whole lifetime studying, interpreting, reading. He was a devotee of Vedanta, not a student, a devotee. You can think many examples, Max Muller, Paul Dewson, and many. So, because this Vedantic philosophy is not about one religion, it is not about one culture, one tradition, it's about the spiritual heritage of humanity as a whole. That's what I find. Anyway, tomorrow we'll continue the discussion and you can have interaction. Perhaps if you ask questions, I will be able to deal with topics which I won't get time to discuss because we have only 5 sessions and 46 verses. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Maharaj, what is enlightenment?
Eh?
People get enlightened.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Enlightenment, I say again, you know, all the scriptures tell you it cannot be explained. So I cannot explain what the sages claim is beyond explanation. But I should try. Yeah, but again, there are indications.
I heard Buddha Sanjiji,
yeah.
They are all enlightened.
Yeah, I will tell you.
Enlightened?
Yeah, eh?
Me?
Huh? Well, I'm trying to be. Okay. So. I tell you, none of them ever claimed we are enlightened, didn't do that. You say, yeah. But they never claimed. That's why. So then you ask me this question. Anyway, so I'm telling you something, but I tell you one thing. Vedanta scriptures tell you something about this. Vedanta scriptures tell you that an enlightened person, when he feels the presence of the divine within him, he starts looking upon others, whole humanity, as a spiritual family. So spiritual oneness and unity, affinity, in while interacting with others and life. That's one common characteristic explained in the scriptures. So one important and a very interesting aspect of traditional scriptures, if you read these books, you know, this, the sages tell you, it is said a long back when I had discussion with the sage, he told me this. This is how ideas are put there. They never tell you, well, here I'm teaching you. No. That's a very interesting thing. So in the Bhagavata Purana, which I quoted, Mahabharata, everywhere, Maitreya said like this. If you ask Maitreya, Narada once upon a time told me this. If you ask Narada, he will say, Maitreya once upon a time told me this. Or if you ask both of them, they will say, Brahma once upon a time told me this. So very often, it is said in the scriptures, I was told like this. This is how they put these great ideas. That means they never mention their own name as the exponents of any of this philosophy, because it is apaurisheya, it is eternal. It is a kind of teacher succession, guru shishya prachishya parampara succession. But what I can tell you is when a person gets spiritually enlightened, what really happens, all the borders, all the dividing barriers, fences collapse. You start looking upon people around you as one spiritual family. This is the only visible characteristic you can think of. In the Bhagavad Gita, from 55th verse to 72nd verse, 18 verses, Lord Krishna gives a long list of characteristics of spiritually enlightened people. There are many, Dukkesu, Anidhikdhamana, Sukhesu, Vigadas, Purha, etc. But one recurring theme is this. They look upon all around them as one spiritual fraternity. And this is more or less true, not only in Vedanta or Hinduism. You find, if you read Eckhart, if you read the Russian mystical literature, if you read Way of a Pilgrim, Philokalia, you find a recurring theme, I mean, an idea or a concept of looking upon all others as one spiritual family. All the barriers, all the socio-anthropological dividing walls will collapse. This is something that you find in all the great monks who you mentioned, in their life and also in their interaction with others. Don't you think so? Okay, thank you.
In the 1950s, yeah, there was an exhibition, a photographic exhibition, called The Family of Man. I just want to share that apropos of what you have just said. Earlier, Justin from Sacramento asked you a question about the relative and the absolute.
Yeah.
And as a visual artist familiar with Hindu symbolism and Buddhist symbolism, it brings forth the sun and the moon. And the sun being absolute, always shining, the illumination of Surya, and then Chandra, the moon, which is getting its light from the absolute. So there is an interchange here going on all the time. And then in mysticism, 3 days before the new moon, is the moon disappears. And this brings to this person's mind the reincarnation. The illumination comes back. The reflection of the absolute. So there is almost a cosmic humanitarian dance between the sun and the moon. And I just wanted to share that because it's beautiful imagery.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. No, it is a charm and beauty and transcendent effect on it. Truth here, what means anubhuti or experience? Shankaracharya says a statement about truth, a philosophical statement, is the penultimate state. But beyond that penultimate state is the real thing which is beyond statement. So, the language of experience is silence. Experience can never be explained. In a way, all of us who study these scriptures have some kind of experience, not ultimate experience. Unless you experience a kind of joy or inner contentment, when you listen to these Vedantic lectures, you won't be able to withstand the assault of Vedanta. Because there is no entertainment here, nothing very funny or humorous. And you are talking about things which you cannot really read in newspapers or vindicate by any other tangible, visible proof. So unless you have some kind of an experience, I don't say the highest, but I mean to say, unless you have a taste of the transcendental aspect of this and feeling at home with this, you won't be able to come and listen to these things. So a place or an idea that you feel at home with is actually your own state. You know, when you go to a place or when you read a book, you feel a great affinity for ideas expressed there. Unless you have some kind of spiritual sadhanas which you have accumulated in your system, you won't be able to connect. Oh, Vedanta and yoga and Buddhism, they will take you to previous life experiences, spiritual practices you had done in previous life and so on. But anyway, you won't be able to strike a new ground without getting bored, really. That familiarity may not be from this life. That's what Vedanta and yoga and Buddhism will tell you. It will be from another source. So even to enjoy reading a book on Vedanta, it takes some kind of inner desire for higher things. That is also some kind of an experience. And what you're talking about, the Jiva Brahma identity, Jiva Brahma Ikya, the highest Advaitic experience, that cannot be explained. Because it is something that you can reach, understand through experience and not experienced, and not explained. So in connection to this, which I mentioned earlier, how does a human being react after this experience? That's one thing that you can ask. How does a human being react? Not the way the Paramahamsa reacted in that book, you know. You find such characters in Dostoevsky, the Zosima, Father Zosima, you find. Father Parapon, you find. In any book dealing with mystical literature, you come across people who transcend conventions and normal do's and don'ts. They seem to reach a realm where they transcend all the man-made barriers of do's and don'ts, you know. They may not tell you thank you, have a great day, if you give them something. Because these conventions and traditions are irrelevant for those who are always living in that state of experience. That's, you find such characters in all traditions. Okay, coming to subject, you know, again, Shankaracharya makes a very interesting statement in one of the commentaries. That is, he says, Rajnyaha Veena Vadhanava, that's the means. How a highly enlightened spiritual person lives in this world. Okay, very. The statement is this. It is like a king playing his violin in his own court. Now, it needs a lot of explanation. Suppose a king is an amateur violinist. He wants to play. He plays in his court, and all the courtiers are around ministers. They won't be angry if his performance is very good, if he's not very good. He can be relaxed because he's a master. So even he can play as he wants, his performance may not be of very high order. But suppose he invites a professional violinist and asks him to play in the court, he'll be anxious. Because if he doesn't put up a very good performance, he may be punished in medieval times, in the early days, you know, where kings had the power to punish. So a professional performer coming to a court, playing to please a king, is not his master. He's anxious. He's worried. He's not free. But a king, he can play as he wants. He is his own master. He's free. He's not worried. So when you reach the highest spiritual experience, you go beyond all the worries. Dukkeshu anudikdhamana, sukheshu vigadaspraha. In the Gita, you find in the description of Siddha Prajna, I mean, spiritually enlightened person. He is not shocked. He is not worried about any painful or pleasant experiences. He transcends both. So that equanimity of mind, the perfect equanimity of mind, one visible sign of a spiritually enlightened person. That's it. Gita tells us, Tulya Ninda Sudhir Mauni, you know, if you praise him also, he's not, he may react, but he's not too much bothered. And if you blame also, he's not too much bothered. The equanimity of mind is actually a sign of wisdom in ordinary empirical sense, but in his spiritual dimension, it is this a sign of a spiritually enlightened person. Yeah.
Hello. I have a question. So what I'm struggling with is I do hear that as a human being, my material and, was it efficient, essence is Brahman. But as a human being, I also live with the karma that I've accumulated diligently over my lifetimes. So the difficulty that I have is, let's say if my karma is poverty, I take it with peace. But if part of my karma is lack of mental ability and lack of titiksha, there doesn't seem to be a way out of it. So what I'm trying to find is this path where I am not pissy with myself when I don't do things right, yet move through with some kind of peace.
Yeah. Okay, doctrine of karma is not fatalism. It is not predeterminism. It is a very flexible thing. So within the karma doctrine itself, there is a way to come out of it. If any experience that we have in this life, if we interpret as a result of some actions, karmas in the past, you can undo it by doing some good actions. Again, I can give the illustration from a very ancient book, because all I read are from only great works which I try to meditate. So I can't say these are my ideas, you know. Yeah. As Swami Vivekananda says, if somebody tells you, I am giving you new truth, don't trust him. Vivekananda repeats this 3 times in Inspired Talks, twice, and in Jnana Yoga lectures, he says once, if somebody tells you, I am now giving you new truth, which was never revealed to anybody in the past, don't trust him. Keep away from him. So, but anyway, coming to subject, what I mean to say, what I will say, Shankaracharya says, and Vivekananda, life of Holy Mother, in our Sri Ramakrishna, you find this. Karma is not predeterminism. You're on any kind of your spiritual practice. You meditate once, you do some noble deed, or you pray once, or even if you feed your mind good ideas by reading high spiritual classics, that can have some effect on your karma. They can reduce the intensity. Holy Mother says, Sarada Devi says, if you are destined to be bitten by a cobra, you may be bitten by a water snake. And if you are destined to be bitten by a water snake, you may be bitten by an ant or an insect. So our spiritual practices can completely neutralize or reduce the intensity of whatever you are destined to enjoy or suffer. This is a very important point. Karma is a very misunderstood word in the West. They often misunderstand as fatalism, something like Calvinistic predeterminism. It's the very opposite of it. Karma, doctrine of karma, actually offers you a royal highway to come out of the shackles of the problems. Any day, any moment, one can do that. That's what Sri Krishna himself tells the Gita. Naki kalyana krit kaschit durgadim tadagachati. You find the sixth chapter. A person who does any kind of noble deed, not externally, even good thought, good ideas, prayer, anything, will neutralize or, depending upon the intensity, reduce the whatever you are destined to suffer. I can explain this in the light of one illustration from the Advaita literature. You know, what you're talking about is prarabdha karma. That's what you're implying. Prarabdha karma means what is responsible for the present life and embodiment. It is like an arrow that has left the bow. Archer has no control over it. The arrow is flying. Archer cannot control. But suppose a strong wind blows. Suppose another object comes in between the arrow and the target it is supposed to hit. The arrow doesn't have to hit the target. Arrow has to extinguish its velocity. Arrow doesn't necessarily have to hit the target. Hitting the target means its velocity is removed. When another obstacle or a strong wind blows, the arrow's velocity is gone. So whatever noble deed, prayer, meditation, or even a desire, anything, any noble spiritual practice you do is like a strong wind that blows or an obstacle that comes in between the arrow and the target it is supposed to hit. This is a very important point in the Vedantic literature. You find this stressed and emphasized again and again by Holy Mother and also in some of the writings of direct disciples. Karma is not an infallible, non-negotiable dictator. It is something very flexible. If you have a will, you can come out of the shackles of your karma. I tell you an example. Mrs. Gandhi was India's prime minister. So she was making fun. One should practice niskama karma and non-nishkarma kama. So she used to attend Swami Ranganathan's lectures in Delhi Ramakrishna Mission for a long time. So very often we mistake karma to be a kind of infallible, non-negotiable, terrible dictator. It's almost like Lutheran or Calvinistic predeterminism. Like, you know, you have no choice. God has already chosen what he decided what to give you. No. But Advaita takes this opposite view. We can decide and make God give you what you want if you are ready to take up the task. That's a beauty and charm of Vedanta. Very often these things are terribly misunderstood in Indian tradition, everywhere. Karma, I did not get a parking lot because of my bad karma. So no way trying to do it. These are all laughable, ridiculous examples of misinterpretations of Vedantic ideas, concepts. Karma is a highly flexible thing. Yes, I did. Okay.
Swamiji, in the morning you were explaining about Brahman and Atman, yeah. like what context we change. You know, we refer to Brahman and Atman. Is it same thing, something like Jivatma and Paramatma? That what I heard before in some discourses is like everyone has a soul, that blissful soul that you are talking about, everyone, that is Jivatma. And the Paramatma is that supreme soul, and he connects everybody through that Jivatma, Paramatma kind of the relationship. So is that Brahman and Atman can be that way, that the Brahman is a big one, and Atman is a part of it?
Yeah. Okay, now, of course, I should have said the beginning itself. When I talk about Vedanta, I focus on Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya system. According to Ramanuja, if you think of a triangle, and suppose you think God is above, on two sides, Jiva and Jagat, the Ramanuja will tell you, Ishvara as God is inherent, Antaryami, in Jagat and Jiva, but still different. It's called Aprita Shakti, non-different. So, Ramanuja believes that Ishvara evolves to Parinama, Brahma Parinama Vada, and becomes different things in this world, Jagat, and different Jivas. Madhvacharya tells you that every Jiva is permanently, inseparably different from every other Jiva. And everything in this world is different from everything else. And God is different from every Jiva, and God is different from everything in this Jagat. So it is Pancha Bheda Siddhanta. Advaita tells you that if you remove the Nama Rupa aspect, the Sharira aspect, the body-mind complex dimension, then Atman is within you. Just like saying, you know, well, I can give another example. Madhvacharya will tell you, suppose you have 1,000 pots made of clay, he will tell you every clay pot is different from every other clay pot. He won't, because there may be different vessels made of clay, like big jar may be there, glass may be there, cup may be there. So he tells you, you cannot use a big jar for drinking water. You cannot use a small cup for storing water. So there is a different vyavahara bheda is there. So nama, rupa and vyavahara, name, form and utility, create a complete distinction between every entity from every other entity. Shankaracharya tells you, nama, rupa is there. But before the pot maker made these pots and different utensils, it was clay. You break it, it goes back to clay. So this name and form is there, they are not permanent. Clay is real. You cannot remove clay from a clay pot without destroying it. The clay can exist without name and form, without changing form. But clay pot cannot exist without clay. So what is real? Clay is real, clay pot is relative. This is Shankaracharya Advaita view. So I don't know what view you heard, but according to Vedanta, this divine reality, the divine spark is present in everything in this world, everyone in this world. If we practice spiritual practices, if you do karma yoga, when our mind becomes pure, then we realize the transitoriness, the changeable nature of this body-mind complex. And we also realize the eternal nature of Atman, which is embodied within us. So Jivatma and Paramatma are the same according to Advaita Vedanta. According to Madhya Siddhanta, every Jivatma is different from every other Jivatma. Everything in this Jagat is different from everything else in this Jagat. Ramanuja says, Ishvara is inherent, present in everything, still different. Present, that's why Chit Achit Visishta Advaita. Ramanuja system is Advaita, but Chit Achit Visishta. Shankaracharya takes a very universal view. He says, well, the whole mango tree is inherent in the mango seed. You put in a fertile soil, pour water, you cannot get a coconut tree. Only mango tree comes, which means mango was inherent there. It is called, you know, it was already there with him. So that is an important. So what you heard, I don't know what you heard, but I'm just presenting before you, according to Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya, the non-dualistic philosophy, whole creation is spiritually one entity. Names and forms and distinctions and differences are only apparent, not real. Gita, you know, Bhagavad Gita itself is subject to different interpretations. Gita has been interpreted in so many different ways. The first and the oldest and, according to scholars, the most important commentary is by Shankaracharya. He was the first great Vedantin who wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. See, Bhagavad Gita itself is not necessarily the best among the Gita. There are 18 Gitas in our tradition. There are any number of Gitas in the Bhagavata Purana and also in the Mahabharata. Uttara Gita, Sudhi Gita, Vyadha Gita, Ashtavakra Gita and so on. Of which Bhagavad Gita is not the most profound. It became a world spiritual classic because Shankaracharya wrote a commentary on it. So Bhagavad Gita got this spiritual profound dimension because of the commentary. So, of course, you know, I won't disturb anybody's faith system. It's okay. But according to great thinkers like Vivekananda, we are traveling from Dvaita, dualism, towards Advaita going through the intermediary stage of Ishtadvaita. So Madhva you start, through Ramanuja you reach Advaita. That's the idea. Okay. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. So we will start our session tomorrow at 10 o'clock as today. Thank you.